conclusions we made yesterday with a BCS theory. So let me just remind you of what they were. The first point is the BCS theory has a Hamiltonian with attraction that leads to pairing between fermions. And we define an order parameter which describes that pairing. That order parameter ultimately for BCS theory turns out to be the gap parameter in the single particle spectrum. Okay, so what you have here is the density of states. So here's the Fermi surface in K space. All these states are filled up. And the Fermi surface reconstructs in the, I should say the ground state reconstructs in the presence of pairing and opens up this gap, delta of T. So the ground state now, if you want to perturb it, you have to break these bound states. And that costs an energy delta, which shows up as a gap in the spectrum. And it also shows up in all other quantities. For example, if you look at the specific heat at low temperatures is exponentially suppressed, because the only way to create excitations is by breaking these pairs. And since you are suppressing the specific heat, you get this pileup close to TC. And the way to think about it is, if I look at specific heat divided by temperature and integrate it, that gives you the entropy up to that temperature that you integrate to. So C over T is a very nice quantity to look at. If you just look at the area under the curve, it gives you the entropy. So you're losing entropy below TC. I should mark TC on this. You're losing entropy here because the ground state, the superconducting state has a lower entropy, and that entropy has to be regained close to TC because ultimately, you have to go back to the normal state entropy. Okay, so it has this very basic form. And the interesting thing is that near TC, there is a jump, which is a finite jump, and this is exactly what is predicted by mean field theory. And as I showed you, there is actual data which supports this finite jump. And this is really the only transition for which you will see this mean field behavior. So today what we want to do is we want to get away from the microscopics. We are going to ask a more general question where in situations where we may not have a very deep understanding about the microscopics, we can still make progress. And so we are going to look at behavior near TC. We are going to look at behavior near TC and kind of address the nature, the behavior by which the order parameter is approaching zero. So we are going to focus on this regime where the order parameter has become very small and try to write some kind of an effective theory for that region, okay? So we are going to go away from all the microscopics of pairing and breaking of pairs and all that picture to closer to TC. Okay. And in fact, that's the way it happened in superconductivity. This theory predates the microscopic theory by 7 years. So they used tremendous intuition to come up with this effective theory in the absence of all this knowledge of exactly what was the order parameter and what that there was this pairing and so on. And so the main idea here was to generalize. So Ginsberg, in particular, the way he enters this picture is that the Landau theory for phase transitions was generalized for superconductivity. And the main point here is to, first of all, postulate an order parameter. You may not know exactly what it is, but you postulate an order parameter psi of r, which, as we know now, is, so this was postulated to be some complex scalar. So this is some complex scalar. And we know, I will keep making connections with microscopics because we have that now available, and you can connect with what we have been talking about. But this, as we have discussed, is this particular expectation value, C down at R, C up R. Okay. This R here refers to the center of mass of the Cooper pair. We can also look at the relative behavior of the Cooper pair, but let's not get into that. I'm assuming it's a S wave. So R will refer to the center of mass of the Cooper pair. So that's the order parameter. And the main idea behind the Ginsberg-Landau approach is to write down a free energy functional. And I'll tell you what that means, free energy functional, just based on symmetry. And we are going to assume a few things. We will assume that psi is small, close to a continuous phase transition. Near TC. And the second thing we will assume is that we will retain only slow variations. In psi. So that means gradient of psi will be taken to be, only keep the gradient psi square terms only. And in today's discussion, I will also assume it's a charged field. So it couples to the electromagnetic radiation through the vector potential. So there's psi is a charged field. So minus I h bar del will be taken to be minus I h bar del minus some E star over C times A. Again, we know from the microscopic theory that E star is equal to 2E. It's the 2E of the Cooper pair. Okay. Okay, so with that, we can then write down so now we can write down the free energy functional F of psi as some F0 plus integral dr alpha mod psi square plus beta over 2 mod psi 4 plus kappa. I'm describing a second order first transition, so I don't have cubic terms, plus kappa del minus I e. I have to decide whether to keep e stars or 2 e's. I kind of go between that. Let me keep e star. That's the gradient term, and then the field energy, 1 over 8 pi del cross A square. Okay. And the reason I call it a functional is because it's not just a function of one variable, it's a function of a function. Psi itself depends on x because of the gradient terms. So a functional means that f is a function of a function. And really, I should be writing it as 2 fields here, psi and psi star. Okay, let me leave it at that first. Okay, so that's the free energy functional. It depends on the magnitude of psi in these two powers. I keep a gradient, and then I have the field energy. And at this point, alpha, beta, kappa are all phenomenological constants. Alpha, beta, kappa are and that's how the theory proceeds. These remain phenomenological constants, which you can fix by connecting with some experiments or by connecting with a microscopic theory. That connection was provided by Gorkov, who connected finally the microscopic theory with the Ginzburg-Landau. Okay, so now the next step is to minimize this functional and by making variation psi. So our two variables, so we'll take f to depend on psi and psi star and also a. And I'm going to take variations of take psi star to psi star is just the complex conjugate of psi. This would go to psi star plus some variation delta psi star. And then we will get one equation by solving the variation of f with respect to psi star and setting it equal to 0. Because we want to find that value of psi star that minimizes the free energy. And the second equation we will get by from the electromagnetic equation, A going to A plus delta A. And that will give us minus C delta F by delta A, which is a current operator. That's the current, and that is C over 4 pi del cross H. And I'll be a bit cavalier about these Cs and so on, because C can be set to 1, and then there are some CGS versus SI units, and that's a bit of a nightmare. But okay, we'll keep that. Hopefully you'll get that right. And hopefully that's not even important. Okay, so now we have to do these variations. We will get one equation from here and another one from here, which will tell us what is the current. This will be the supercurrent. Okay, so if we do that, then so I'm going to leave some of the algebra steps here, and you can follow if you want some help with functional integrals. You can, because that will take me like a whole lecture to do that in its entirety. But if you want to look up functional integrals and how you take, the idea is that, say, you have a function of psi of x, and you make, so you have some psi of x here. It's some function, and you make a change in that function. So the function is now, oh, they did. Oh, fantastic. Okay, good. Even better. So with that, then, you can, let me then just write down the two equations. Is that fair enough? Because you can just take the variation with respect to delta psi star, and then you will get Ginzburg lambda 1, which will be obtained by setting delta f by delta psi star equal to 0. And that will give us alpha psi plus beta mod psi square psi plus kappa minus I delta. That's one equation. And we also get a surface term. As you know, from when I work this out, I will get a surface term as well. And that that will be n dot, the normal to the surface, minus I delta acting on psi, normal to the surface, this is 0. And the second equation that we will get is exactly, because you have a potential which itself depends on psi. So this is a Gross-Pitevsky equation. So here, it's a nonlinear, it's a nonlinear Schrodinger equation. You know, it's exactly what you would have written down, let's say, for an electron in a magnetic field. But then, in addition, so that would have been a term like this, barring the fact that there's some effective charge, E star. But then, in addition, there is a potential which depends on psi itself. So it's a nonlinear Schrodinger equation. And we will solve it in a couple of cases to get some idea what we can extract from this. The second equation will give us J is equal to E star over IH bar kappa psi star grad psi minus grad psi star psi. That would have been your usual current operator. And right, minus 2 E star square over H bar square C kappa psi square A. OK, so this is the second one. And once again, there is a surface term, which is n dot j across the surface is equal to 0. OK, so these are the equations. And I will use them now extensively in many cases. So sitting in these equations is a wealth of information, which we are now going to try to extract. Okay, so we will do a bunch of cases. So let's do a problem. One. So the simplest case we can think of is what? Let's forget about the magnetic field. Let's forget about any gradients. And just consider a homogeneous, a bulk, a uniform bulk superconductor. That's the first case. And here I have, let's also take H to be 0. So what you get then from Ginzburg-Landau 1 is alpha psi plus beta mod psi square psi is equal to 0. And in order to describe a phase transition, beta can just be taken to be a constant. But alpha must be of the form where it changes sign at TC. And that is reflected by alpha having a form which is A times little t. Little t is t minus TC over TC. Okay, so if I plot this potential, f of psi as right, I should plot it in the space. It's a complex. Psi is complex, so I should have the real part of psi and the imaginary part of psi. And I plot f in this here. No, I'm just plotting the potential f. And the psi that will be picked will be whatever minimizes f. And then the real free energy will be f, this functional f evaluated at that value of psi. So this is not any, it's not a thermodynamic potential that you will ever measure for any system, this f per se. What you will measure is the free energy evaluated at the optimal psi. So this looks like, so here is f. Yeah. No magnetic field. So right now there's no magnetic field. That's case number one. So this looks like something like this, centered at 0, and that's what you'll find for t greater than TC, or little t greater than 0. But then when you go below TC, and this is always a little harder to draw, but so I'm not going to be able to draw this very well. Let me draw it like this. F of psi. Okay. This is what is often called the Mexican hat potential. Reflecting the fact that you now have minima which move away from 0 to these new locations. And you can rotate that anywhere in the xy plane, and the free energy remains the same. So that's what I mean by that rotation. It's like any point that the minimum moves out into some finite value of psi, and you can go around the circle keeping the magnitude the same, and the free energy is degenerate with respect to all of these different positions around the circle. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to draw there. And that is the U1 gauge symmetry that the system has initially in the Hamiltonian, but the ground state is going to break it by picking one of those points on the circle. Okay, so it's going to pick one of the points on the circle, and that will be how it will fix the angle for this order parameter. but its magnitude is something we can calculate from that expression. Okay, so from here we can see, let me sort of finish this, I should write here, t less than tc and little t less than 0. And this is also delta F, which will be called the condensation energy. Okay. So by solving this, what we will get is psi naught square is equal to 0. This is the value at which F is minimized. It's 0 for T greater than TC, and it is alpha over beta. So let me write that as A mod T over beta for T less than TC. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. This was the, I've taken, that integral is just a constant, so I can, I don't have any gradients, right? So that integral just gives me a volume, okay? In general, there is an integral because things are varying in space. Psi would be varying in space. But if I have everything is homogeneous, then I can psi is a constant. I can do the integral. I get a volume. I can, if you want, I can write this as a little f. So this is free energy per unit volume, if you want. So this would be f that we wrote down per unit volume. Okay? Okay, so the key thing that we see here is that this quantity psi naught, which is this value here. This value here is psi naught. So psi naught, the mod of that, goes like this. It's a little sharper than linear. I want to show it as a, okay. It goes like t to the power half. This is tc. Okay, so mod psi, the magnitude of the order parameter builds up at TC with the square root behavior, which is the mean field beta exponent. Okay, so that's the order parameter. And now at that value of psi zero, we can calculate the free energy. Is everybody with me? Question? No. So now I can evaluate F at psi zero, or F per unit volume at psi zero, and that will be minus alpha square over beta plus beta over 2. So I'm putting it into that expression there, alpha square over beta square, and that gives me alpha square over, sorry, minus alpha square over 2 beta. Okay, so this is the amount by which the free energy is lowered. So clearly it starts out at TC being the two free energies of the superconductor and the normal state are equal, and then the superconducting state starts getting lowered by that much amount as it marches down. Okay, so if you want to put it in terms of little t, this is minus a square little t square over 2 beta. Okay? Now, since we do have the connection with microscopics, let me just mention what it is. But you know, we don't really need that to do the Ginzburg-Landau, but since we have the microscopic theory, we have this alpha of t is nothing but, I had written it as at, so that is n0 times little t. So that a that we have been talking about is just a density of states. And it multiplies little t, which is t minus tc over tc. Okay, and beta is, you know, I've taken it to be a constant, and it is not totally constant, but it is a very weak function of temperature. So we are very well justified in making a constant out of it. And when compared with the microscopic theory, it is some constants n0 over tc squared. Okay? So all I'm trying to say is that in retrospect, the Ginzburg-Landau assumptions are very well justified. Okay, so that's what we get for a bulk superconductor. It captures what we expect about the second order phase transition, that the order parameter is vanishing with a certain exponent, and the free energy is lowered. Also, if you look at the entropy from here by taking a derivative of the free energy, it will have a jump exactly in terms of alphas and betas. So you can see that just with these two phenomenological parameters, we can get the behavior, and you can now easily compare with experiments and fix these values, and you can check them against one another because they are overdetermined by the number of experiments you have. Okay, so now let's come to more interesting situations where we start to perturb the system in different ways. So the first thing you could do, we want to see the effect of the gradient, let's say. Okay, so let's put, the simplest thing would be that we have, so that now I come to problem number two. Where I'm going to put a superconductor with a wall. H is still equal to zero. Okay, so I'm slowly bringing in, it's like a little drama here, one by one, the different players in this. So now comes the wall. And here is the wall. Right? So we know that our order parameter is a constant. This is my x variable here. I'm even going to do this problem in one dimension. So my order parameter is a constant deep in the superconductor. And as I come toward the edge of the wall, as I hit the wall, the order parameter has to go to zero at the edge because there's no superconductivity on the other side. And the question is, what is the scale? So we know it has to do something like this. You know, it'll have some shape. We will calculate it, and I'm already predicting the correct shape. It could have been anything. You would have brought it down, you know, rounded, and it would have vanished at x equal to zero. And the question we want to ask is, what is the scale? So on what scale does the order parameter bend? Okay, that's the meaning of the gradient. You're trying to bend the order parameter. It's going to cost some energy to bend it, and what will that length scale be? So for this, once again, we go to the Ginzburg-Landau equation. Number one, And let's see, I missed a step here. Okay. So I have now Ginzburg-Landau 1, and I have psi will be real, and A is 0. So with that, what do I write down? I have alpha psi plus beta mod psi square psi minus h bar square over 2 m star del square psi is equal to 0. I've used also the fact that k is equal to h bar square over 2 m star. Again, from the microscopic theory, m star turns out to be 2m. Okay, so we just have a Schrodinger equation to solve, and we can do this. I define. Yes? Psi real comes from the fact that typically, psi will be start becoming complex if the phase is important. So all the time, think of the order parameter as having an amplitude and a phase. And the question is, what is being affected? So you can put in a complex psi, and you will find in the end it will be real. But I'm giving you the intuition to know when to put, when will the complex aspects of psi become important. If you have something which couples to the phase, like a magnetic field, which starts giving it a rotation, then the fact that psi is complex will truly become important. So we will see that in that situation. Here, all we are doing is that we are putting something which is forcing the order parameter to go to 0. It's largely going to affect the magnitude.
So you didn't have to consider psi complex?
Yeah, I didn't have to. Okay, there I put it in just to show you the symmetry breaking. Okay, finally, the whole analysis only required modulus of psi going to 0 at TC. The reason for putting in the complex psi was to say that it picked one of those infinite possibilities. But once having picked it, it was only the amplitude that was governing it. But you'll see, I'm coming to other problems where the phase of the order parameter will become important. Okay, so define f, which is psi over psi infinity. Okay, and if you do that, you can get an equation here, which will be minus h bar square over 2 m star mod alpha y double prime, I'm sorry, I keep calling it y, f double prime plus f minus f cube equal to 0. Okay? And I could define from here a characteristic length, which is, so define c square t, which is h bar square over 2m star alpha. And alpha goes like a times t, so this implies that c will go like t to the minus half. This is also the nu equal to half exponent, which is also the mean field value. Okay? So now we can solve this. It turns out this differential equation can be solved exactly. And Dennis, is this a homework problem or something? No. So then I should solve it exactly. Okay. So this has an exact solution, which is nice. And if you didn't know that it was exact, you can still try to get some handle on it by, near the edge. The F cube term is very small, so you can expand it. There are these kinds of tricks you can also play. But since there is an exact solution, let me give it to you. But it's also interesting to look at it perturbatively when F is small by neglecting the cubic term and so on. So it turns out that d by dx, this you can write, d by dx of c square f prime square over 2 plus half f square minus f fourth over 4. This is equal to 0. Okay, so this implies that the term in the brackets, this term in the brackets, must be equal to a constant. Okay? So to calculate the constant, consider a point far from the boundary and there F prime is equal to 0 because psi has become a constant and F square is equal to 1. So what you get is C square, that term in the brackets, which I'm not going to write again. So the term in the brackets becomes 0 plus half minus a quarter. These are the three terms, and that's equal to a quarter. So that's the constant. So now we know that C square F prime square over 2 plus F square over 2 minus F to the fourth over 4 is equal to 1 quarter. And we can manipulate this and get it into the form C square F prime square is equal to half 1 minus F square whole square. And you can show that this has a solution psi x over psi infinity, which I had defined as f of x is tan x over root 2 c. Okay, so it's a tan, and that's why I had drawn it to be a linear. But now let's try to look at that behavior as a function of temperature. So here is the wall. And if I look at it at two different temperatures, here is my psi infinity, and it's bending on some scale, like this. So this is at some t. T equal to T1, less than TC. Okay. As I increase the temperature, what's going to happen? Psi infinity is going to drop, right? Because my order parameter is decreasing. Psi infinity is the order, so here is the behavior. So the psi infinity as a function of temperature, mod of that, looks like this. That's the square root. So as I increase the temperature, so let's say T1 is somewhere here. That point here is T1. Let me go to a temperature. No, I'm doing it the other way. Here is T1, and I'm going to go to T2. Okay, so at T1, the order parameter is large, and it decreases on some scale C. As I come toward T2, the order parameter drops in its values, it has dropped to something like this. But also Xi, you can see from there, is becoming bigger as I come toward the transition. So on this, I should also draw what Xi is doing. This is Xi of t. Okay, that is diverging as a square root. So that means this is going to decay on a longer scale. Here. So this is T1, and that is T2. The order parameter is dropping in value. So here I'm plotting psi of x. This is x. This is psi infinity of x. The point is psi infinity of x is temperature dependent, so it's decreasing as I increase the temperature, and the length scale over which the decrease happens is growing with temperature. It is growing as I approach the critical point. So this is now bigger. And finally, as you approach TC, that length scale is becoming very, very large. Okay, so a good way to get an understanding of Xi is that Xi of T is the scale over which the order parameter bends. And one can estimate it just very simply. I didn't even have to do this whole differential equation story. It's good to do that once because now you have the exact result. But in general, you can always estimate this length scale from the energy gap or from the condensation energy. And this theory doesn't know about the gap. So we have h bar square over 2m star del psi square is going to be on the order of delta F0, the condensation energy. And that was alpha square over beta. That was of that order. Okay. So right from here, you can see that 1 over C square, this scale here, I'm going to write down as psi 0 square over C square, because that's the gradient on that scale. And from that, we can estimate, from here, we can estimate that 1 over C square will go like T. And that implies that C will go like T to the minus half. OK? Question?
What happened to that negative sign behind, minus sign behind that F double prime?
Which minus sign, sorry? It's all there. I don't know which minus sign are you talking about. Are you talking about this one? Oh, that. Maybe I made a mistake. I should have minus F square and so on. You're right. There is a minus sign, which is, so it's H bar square over all of that. I mean, finally, what I've written is right, but what I had was right. So this minus sign shouldn't be there. So let's see. In my original equation, let's go back to the Ginzburg-Landau one. Let's see. I have alpha psi yeah, there. I have alpha minus, so this is correct.
The minus.
Pardon?
You need the minus.
I need the minus sign. I do have the minus h bar, so that is correct. So that Ginsburg is correct. Then I have 2m with a f double prime, that is correct. Plus f minus f cube, all of that is correct. Plus f. I see. I see where the issue is. Yeah, let me fix that. Okay, so this is correct, right? And then I define f by this, right? And okay, so that's there. And then, so let me go very slowly here. I have h bar square over 2m star. Okay, yeah, this is where there is a bit of an error. So let me fix that. Finally, the differential equation we solved was okay, but let me fix from here. Let me do it in another color so we know what we are writing. Okay, so what I will get is, yes. So what I want to put in is this fact, that psi, actually, let me do it here. Psi infinity square is minus alpha over beta, and this is greater than zero. Okay, that's where that minus sign got messed up. So the order parameter, so remember alpha is becoming negative below TC, right? That's how the Mexican hat potential gets developed, because it changes sign. So it becomes negative, that negative makes it positive. So now what I have is, let's go slowly there, I have h bar square over 2m star del square psi del square f minus alpha f minus beta times minus alpha over beta f cube. Okay, this is equal to zero. So I've taken my minus signs to the other terms, and I have put in the expression here for psi infinity. And now you will see that everything will go through. So what I will get is, let's do it again, one more step here. Del square f yeah plus, and then that will follow. Yeah, so now it's okay. From here, it was this minus that I had missed up there, but then it will go into and give you that. Okay, so I had sort of missed this negative in front of psi infinity square. Okay, so that's the, okay, let me move to the other side. So that's the behavior near a wall. It allows us to extract one of the two length scales. And now what we want to do is to go after the vector potential terms. So let me move this up. And you should just, if the minus sign is still missing, that's something you can fix. But it's those ingredients that go into that. Sorry, you have a question? Yeah, just 1 second. I can't hear you. Yeah.
Does this solution have to set have to satisfy the second equation in Ginsburg's lemma 1.
Yeah.
But
wait, you don't have.
It says that divergence on the normal.
There is no vector potential. Okay. So right now there is no vector potential. I'm not going to put it in.
You didn't have any charge, so there's no vector.
Okay. So next, let's come to problem number 3.
But that's E.
Yes. This was just a heuristic argument that's important. So let me say what is the heuristic argument. The argument is that the superconductor has gained some free energy, right? And how much did it gain? It gained that delta F zero. This was without any gradients. Right, that's what we calculated. For the homogeneous system, this is how much the superconducting state has a lower energy, the amount is delta F zero. When you put a gradient, it costs energy to do that. And the length scale, you can just get by writing down the cost in energy, that's the kinetic energy cost for bending psi, and you equate the two energies to extract that length scale. That's the argument. That the system will, by bending, it will cost some energy, and that energy can only be as much as the condensation energy. But this is a typical way to get length scales. So whenever you have a problem with some energy scale, you can get the corresponding length scale in these kinds of ways. That's why I emphasize that, because it's a very good hand-waving manner to extract length scales and energy scales. So now we come to another length scale that is hidden in the problem. So that length scale has to do with the currents that move around in the superconductor. So now next we come to, again, so this is now problem 3. So this is now problem. Where again we go back to a bulk superconductor. In a magnetic field. Okay, so each time we are bringing in some complexity, but not all of it together. You know, that's like throwing the kitchen sink into the problem. You have a magnetic field, you have walls, you have gradients, everything. That'll be too complicated. So the next step is bulk again, so no gradients of psi, but the vector potential is there. So now from Ginsburg-Landau 2, what we get is J is equal to, so here we can say order parameter psi of r is equal to mod psi, constant amplitude, and let's say uniform phase. So we can take a gradient of theta also to be 0. In this case, J is going to be minus from Ginsburg 2, which can we see? Yeah, that term, minus 2. K is h bar square over 2m star. So that gives me, so here I have taken k is h bar square over 2m star. So that gives me E star square over M star C psi square A. Okay, and if I put all these E stars, etc., etc., that also comes out to be minus NS E square over MC, where what have I done? I have written E star to be 2E, M star to be 2M, and psi square to be NS over 2. This is the superfluid density. All that is not important. The crucial thing is this, that it is minus all that times A. And this is also, some of you may recognize it as London's equation, which he had written down phenomenologically. But here, we have actually gotten it out of the second Ginzburg equation. And we'll discuss what it means. But first of all, let's look at it. It is proportional to the vector potential, and there is a negative sign there. Okay? Okay, so let's get a little idea about what this means. This is a very important equation, and hidden in it are some aspects of the transport behavior of the superconductor. So the first thing you can notice from here is that if I look at delta J by delta T, this, by the way, I can also put an S. This is the supercurrent. This is the current carried by the super electrons, by the superfluid. It's the supercurrent, sometimes also called supercurrent. Okay, so this is minus N E square over MC, delta A by delta T, but that is the electric field, times delta A by delta T, but then 1 over C, okay, this, but this is equal to NS E square over M times the electric field, where minus 1 over C, delta A by delta T is equal to the electric field. Okay, so what that says is if I look at, if I Fourier transform this, then this says that J of omega is going to be I, there will be an important I, times NS E square over M omega times E of omega. Okay? And that says, so if you recall, J is usually defined to be conductivity times E. J is sigma times E. Sigma is the conductivity. And what you're seeing is an imaginary term there. So that says the current is out of phase with the electric field. It's not in phase. So there is no dissipative component. It's purely reactive. It's purely reactive. And that's what makes it like an inductor. That's what makes a superconductor like an inductor. It's, if it was in phase, there would be a resistive part of the response, because the current is in phase with the electric field, it can absorb from the electric field. But in this case, because it's out of phase, it acts like an inductor. So this also brings, you know, I just want to touch base with one question I raised in the first day, which was, here is a system which has a gap. You know, we calculated that gap microscopically. And the question I asked was, what is another system you know that has a gap? And you all said it was a semiconductor. Now, how can a superconductor and a semiconductor both have gaps in their spectrum. One have infinite conductivity and one have zero conductivity. And the answer to that is right here, that if you look at the real part of sigma of omega, this is the dissipative. This is what you call, mean by resistance. What you are seeing here is that this quantity, of course, has a gap in a superconductor. That gap is 2 delta. So it starts absorbing only for frequencies above 2 delta. But at zero frequency, it has a delta function peak. This is, and the strength of that is ns e square over m delta omega. And this is coming from the supercurrents that are accelerating. And not being dissipative. OK. But now, marching on with the so the imaginary part was I omega. If you take the real part, so the conductivity would be this term here. This would be sigma of omega. If I take the real part of that, I will get a delta function at omega. Okay. From here, if I take the real part of this I over omega, I will get a delta function at omega equal to 0. And that's what shows that the supercurrents are not moving at a constant velocity. If I apply an electric field and the system is accelerating, the signature of that is in that delta function. So the answer to the question about semiconductors versus superconductors, semiconductors will have a spectrum very much like this without the delta function peak. So the infinite conductivity is coming from those supercurrents. Okay? And the spectrum can still have a gap. The gap is reflecting the absorption by broken pairs, but the supercurrent will carry this velocity, which will be not dissipative. And that's also the origin of those circulating currents. Just a minute. Oh, sorry. Yes, you had a question? Does it mean there are Cooper pairs? Yes, exactly. So the Cooper pairs are, so the way to picture this is that I have applied a vector potential or an electric field. And the Cooper pairs in that electromagnetic potential are accelerating. Okay? So in other words, if I were to this is an important point, so let me say that in another way. So we are actually, you know, we saw this delta JS. This green won't work too well. We saw the delta J by delta T was, what was the expression I had? I have that expression as a function of electric field was NS E square over M times E. Okay, now J is NSEVS. It's NEV, the number of super electrons, velocity, and the charge. So if I put that in here, you will see what you get is M delta VS by delta T is EE. Okay, that's what I mean by super, the Cooper pairs or the super electrons, super current is acceleration, pure acceleration. Okay, you should, so what you're seeing is that the electric field takes the superfluid part and just accelerates it. It does not, I want you to contrast this with what would happen in a typical metal. If you were writing down such an equation for electrons, what you would get is, of course, a term like this, but then there would also be some scattering. So that finally, it's not that the electric field would not be proportional to the acceleration, but to the velocity. Okay, this is a very big difference between a metal and a superconductor. Electric field would not be proportional to the acceleration, but the velocity, and that's what would give you a finite conductivity. Now, in these systems, because it's proportional to the acceleration, it ends up giving you that delta function at omega equal to zero. So this sort of also explains how come when you have all these, the same amount of disorder in the metal, when you go below TC, how come now that disorder doesn't affect the electrons anymore? And the answer is that they have formed a fluid, which is this very special coherent fluid. And because they are all moving together, those little imperfections don't matter. And the fluid going together individually, they would get scattered. But because it's one coherent fluid, the whole thing can move without any dissipation. Okay, so that's what the second Ginzburg-Landau equation tells us. But it tells us even more. Let's look at what the field is doing, the magnetic field is doing. So here is now going back to del cross J, I take that equation there, which is J, let me write that first. It's J is equal to minus NS E square over MC times A. Okay, I just looked at it by taking A into the electric field, by taking its time derivative. I can also look at its curl and look at it as a function of the magnetic field. So if I take curl of J, that is minus N E square over MC curl of A, which is the magnetic field. And if I take another curl, and then I can use this Maxwell equation, which is, so this is Maxwell's equation, which is del cross B is equal to J, and del cross B, which is now 4 pi over C del cross J. But del cross J is this. And so I substitute that. And from here, I can write it as minus del square B. And I've used the fact that del dot B is 0. All those wonderful Maxwell relations. And then I substitute that. The negative signs cancel. And what I get is del square B is equal to 4 pi ns e square over mc square times b. Okay, and this allows us to define another length scale. This is called the penetration depth. So what you're seeing here is that, oops. Yeah, just from here. So lambda L is a length, right? Pardon?
lambda squared.
Oh, lambda squared. Yes, very good. Trying to get this to go up. Yeah, very good. So lambda L is mc squared over 4 pi ns e squared, which is also sometimes called, square root of that, which is also called Yeah, that's right. So the dimensions work out. Okay, so this is now a very interesting length scale. What it says is if I have a superconductor here, this is my superconductor, and I have a magnetic field, which is, let's say, in the z direction coming out of the board. Let me take the magnetic field in this direction. So this is my B. And so bz as a function of x is what I can draw here. And it will look like this. It's coming out of the board, but its magnitude, bz of x, is going to decay as I go into the superconductor on a scale lambda L. So bz of x will go like b0 e to the minus x over lambda, this penetration depth. Okay, so this is coming out of the board. The system is setting up these. So there are a couple of things happening. When you apply the magnetic field, we were talking about the Meissner effect. And we said that the magnetic field is expelled. But it's not just expelled instantly at the boundary. The magnetic field, which is coming out of the board outside the superconductor, it's equal to the applied field. As you go inside the superconductor, the magnitude of that field is starting to decay on a scale of this penetration depth. And the crucial thing is that it's proportional to the density of superelectrons that you have, the superfluid. So it decays on that length scale, and finally, at some point, the superconductor becomes does not have any of these. So what I should say is that in order for it to decay, the superconductor has set up the electrons which are circulating with some current. And it's these currents which are canceling the magnetic field. So let me explain that a little better here. Yes. No.
Accelerate.
It accelerates around. That's what I want to draw for you. I want you to have a picture of these currents.
So it's like a dipole moving in a circle.
Not quite, but
it has.
Yeah. So let me see if I can draw it in some way. Okay. So let us draw it in some way where here's my superconductor. And let's get some directions here. So here is the magnetic field that I have applied, H. This is the external field. And this external field is a constant. Okay? So the field is coming out of the board. Now, deep inside, here, at this point, here at zero, what you have is that B, which is
So if you ever were confused about H and B, and you thought it was kind of irrelevant to be defining so many symbols, now comes the time to really see them in action. So B is H plus 4 pi m. Okay, the 4 pi is again some units. But let's say it's the external field H plus the magnetization. And in the case of the superconductor, it is a diamagnet. So
the magnetization is going to be negative. And in the perfect case, diamagnet would imply that B is equal to zero deep inside, which implies that M is equal to minus 1 over 4 pi H. So chi, which is the susceptibility, which is dm dh, is minus 1 over 4 pi. So this is the maximum the susceptibility can be, the maximum negative value, so as to completely cancel the magnetic field. And it does that deep inside. So at zero, at this point zero here, B is equal to zero. But if you look at points near the wall, B is not instantly zero. What the system has done is it sets up currents. And how do these currents flow? They will flow in this direction, like that. These are the currents, because you can see that if they flow in that direction, which I've shown to be clockwise, the magnetic field generated by these currents will be inside, going into the board. And it will cancel the external field, which is coming out of the board. So these circulating supercurrents cancel part of the magnetic field, part of the external magnetic field. Okay, and if you look at the profile going in, this is zero going into your superconductor, the magnetic field is decaying in this way. That is what I was trying to say, on a scale lambda L. And at x equal to 0, it is just equal to h. So it takes on the external value right at the boundary. Then you have supercurrents which are flowing. They are getting stronger and stronger as you go inside. And finally, it's completely able to kill the magnetic field. And that's then the Meissner effect. So the Meissner effect is this complete shielding with a sheath of current going in inside toward the center where there are no currents. Okay? So the supercurrents are only flowing on the surface. Inside, there are no currents. Why? Because the system actually doesn't want to have these currents. These currents cost energy. They cost the kinetic energy of superflow. So the system doesn't want them. But it is having to pay some amount of it because the magnetic field is generating the currents in the system. Okay, so that's what we have with these currents and the shielding and Meissner effect. Now comes a really beautiful experiment you can do just along these lines, but changing the geometry just a little more. So we've come to like problem 3, where we looked at the magnetic field, and now let's just look at a little variant of this. And so let me move this up. Okay. Yes. Certainly. Is that better? Okay. So next, what we are going to do is to take the same kind of system we had, but make a ring out of it. Okay? Or I can make a cylinder, a hollow cylinder. And now something very sneaky will happen. So I have a hollow cylinder here. And let me put a magnetic field. So this is T greater than TC. And let's draw the field lines. The field lines are going through the system. Right? And let's assume, just to be able to analyze it, that this D is much, much less than lambda. OK, next step, I go below TC. They're supposed to be the same cylinder. It's gotten a bit fatter, but never mind. So now I have these lines. You know that no field can penetrate through the system. So the field lines will bend like this. They won't go through the system. But it can still go through the hole. Yes? Oh, sorry. Yes. Thanks, John. I want them to be able to set up these screening currents. OK, so there's still flux trapped in the hole. So this is T less than TC, flux. Does not penetrate the ring or the material, the thickness, but flux is trapped. In the hole. Okay, so that's step two. I have step one. And now comes step three. And what do? I remove the magnet. I remove the external . Can you see this yellow chalk, or should I shift to? Maybe I should shift to white. OK. And this is what is really cool here. So I remove the magnet. And these flux lines can't just end in thin air. So what they do is they get connected this way. OK, and let's see what is the amount of flux that you have in the system. So the flux phi, this is the flux through the center, through the central hole, cannot just decrease. Why? Because delta phi by delta t would have been an electromotive force, would be the integral of E dot dl around the ring. If I take E dot dl around this ring, that is what, so this is around the ring, and that integral has to be zero, because in a superconductor, we can't have any, because no voltage can build up in a superconductor. So what happens is that as you remove the external field, currents get set up in the superconductor because it does not want the flux to decrease. Okay? So you have induced, as a result of this taking out, it's like Lenz's law. You are trying to change the magnetic field, but the system is resisting it to the fullest, and it does that by setting up a super current. So a super current starts flowing. So here is the super current. So super current starts flowing to oppose the change of flux. And that current will be a persistent current. It will now remain in the superconductor forever. That's the persistent current I had mentioned earlier. But the origin of that you see now as coming from the fact that there is a screening length over which the system is trying to avoid this magnetic field. That, of course, happened in the bulk. Now, if you had a hole, the magnetic field could go through that. But at the same time, when you remove the magnetic field, the external magnetic field, a supercurrent is set up in this material, and that supercurrent will remain persistent. And this is a persistent current, which will live forever. But it's more than that. The amount of flux that will get trapped in that is quantized in units of the flux quantum. So let's see that. So this is our problem number 4. Flux quantization. Okay, so what I'm going to do is to consider a ring and with a hole. Here is a flux phi through that hole. And let me consider a circuit around this ring, which is deep inside the system. So as I said, that I'm taking D to be much, much greater than lambda L. So I take a circuit deep inside where there are no currents. The currents are on the surface here, surface there, but deep inside, let me take a circuit deep inside where J is equal to 0 everywhere on that circuit. So this is my, okay. Now J from that Ginzburg-Landau equation number 2, J is equal to E star H bar over M star mod psi square del theta minus E star over H bar C A. So pretty much what I'm assuming is that the order parameter is mod psi e to the I theta, and mod psi does not depend on the radial coordinate on r, on r or theta, the angular coordinate. I don't want to mess it up with that theta. Or, so let me just say on the radial or angular coordinate. And I'm only concerned about the variation of the phase of the order parameter as I go around that circuit. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to do. And now if I look at J dot DL along that circuit C, then that is 0, just because J is 0. But that tells us that integral DL of gradient of theta minus E star over H bar C A is equal to 0. This thing must be 0. Now, now we have that integral A dot DL is nothing but the flux, right? When I take the vector potential around, that's just the total flux phi through the ring. So this is the total flux through the ring. And if I look at integral dl dot gradient of theta, that must be 2n pi, where n is an integer. So what we find from here is that E star phi over H bar C is 2n pi. Or if I define a flux quantum phi naught to be 8c over E star, which is 8c over 2e, then that implies that so the flux through the ring . Okay, so what we've seen is something quite beautiful. We have seen that in this geometry with a hole, question? Oh, sorry, you're just stretching. Okay, in this geometry with a hole, the magnetic field will penetrate up to some distance, and it will get screened by these screening currents, the supercurrents. But the field in the center has a very special property. The amount of flux this ring will enclose will be quantized in units of this flux quantum, the superconducting flux quantum. You've seen something like this in the Bohr-Maranov effect with an electron going around in a magnetic field, right? Now here, it's the super electrons which are going in, around in a magnetic field. And since they have a charge of 2e, the flux quantum has this factor of 2 difference from the electronic flux quantum. But besides that, what it is saying is that the flux through the hole will be quantized in units of this flux quantum, h over 2e. The c's, you can just ignore. These are just units. But h over 2e is the quantization unit. OK, any questions?
Final state.
How did that?
I mean, before the step one, if the original flux in the pole is not exactly n phi zero, and after step three, how will it should be?
Okay. So that's all done at the level of how the supercurrents are going to flow to achieve that. Okay, so we will see this a little more tomorrow. We will look at the case where, you know, we've sort of discussed Meissner effect, where the field was completely being expelled, at least in the absence of the hole. Now, when you keep increasing the magnetic field, we will look at what are called type 2 superconductors, where the magnetic field will actually penetrate in the form of vortices. And once again, these vortices will carry flux. These vortices will be normal regions which will carry flux, but that flux also will be quantized in units of phi naught. Okay, so we'll see that tomorrow. I'll come back to your question at that time. And then and that's actually a very beautiful topic, because these not only will these vortices carry quantized flux, but they will also organize themselves into a lattice called the Abrikosov lattice. So we'll see that tomorrow, and then. Actually, tomorrow I should say there will be 2 lectures, and then I will wrap up the whole subject with a window into what is the future of superconducting research and superconductivity. Okay, thanks.